At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the show today, a little trade, a little Instagram, and a little therapy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Reis, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, August 4th. Good to have you with us. So tomorrow is going to be a pretty crucial day. That's when we'll get July's job numbers, which will give us a better sense of this economy and could, of course, sway the Fed when making their next interest rate decision. But today, right now, we're going to take a look at unemployment. First-time claims for unemployment ticked up a bit last week to 260,000, up more than 50% since it hit an all-time low back in March. Now, all of that might be causing some angst at state unemployment agencies. Back in the early days of the pandemic, you might remember all those antiquated computer systems that crashed, how people were on hold for hours and hours, and how states dealt with massive processing delays. So, we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, how ready is this economy if we see yet another spike in unemployment claims?
There is some good news for unemployment insurance systems around the country, says Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation.
The Biden administration, they've tried to go at low-hanging fruit, so trying to identify the business processes that slow things down, try to get the states to fix them.
Some states have launched big IT overhauls, but they won't roll out until the mid-2020s.
You know, we may have a recession before those new programs are put into place.
Congress gave the Labor Department $2 billion in pandemic relief funds to help states upgrade their unemployment programs. Michelle Evermore is a deputy director at the agency.
We've deployed teams of experts now to 24 different states, and they actually get into the system, understand what are the hindrances to paying benefits on time, to paying benefits equally, to making sure that they don't go to fraudsters.
Pennsylvania has already revamped its unemployment insurance technology. Julia Simon Michelle is a supervising attorney at Philadelphia Legal Assistance and serves on a national task force on UI.
Things are moving more quickly now than they were during the pandemic. Unfortunately, that's a pretty low bar.
She says the new system is internet-based, which is easier and more efficient for state workers who manage the program. But many low-income and immigrant workers don't have easy internet access or proficiency in English.
For most of the people we see, they are still struggling to navigate the system, to handle new technology, and it's still very difficult to reach the Department of Labor and Industry and get any answers.
Meanwhile, there are widespread staffing shortages at unemployment agencies across the country, as the Labor Department's Michelle Evermore told a congressional hearing last week.
Turnover has been very high, further decreasing the limited capacity. Unless we invest in staff and systems, they will be less effective in responding to the next crisis.
Even if states solve their staffing and technology problems, there are still big disparities between them. when it comes to who's eligible, how much they get, and how long they get it. Jenna Gary is a senior staff attorney at the National Employment Law Project.
The pandemic really exposed the longstanding systemic issues in the UI system that leaves far too many workers, particularly our Black and women workers, shut out of the system entirely.
That's because most states disqualify part-time workers, temps, people who earned too little money in previous quarters, and independent contractors. And Gary says states have been cutting the duration of benefits, which nationwide was 26 weeks going into the pandemic.
We're actually up to 13 states that now offer less than 26 weeks, which a few offering as little as 12 weeks of benefits.
States have also been reducing eligibility by tightening job search requirements, for instance, says the Century Foundation's Andrew Stettner.
Less than 3 out of 10 unemployed individuals are receiving an unemployment check.
That's less than half the percentage at the height of the pandemic. Finally, in spite of recent technology upgrades, most people who file are still waiting a long time before benefits start to flow, says Julia Simon-Michel at Philadelphia Legal Assistance.
People are not getting paid right now at the most vital time, which is the first 2 months after somebody loses a job, the first time that rent payment comes due after you've stopped receiving a paycheck.
The federal standard is that states act on 80% of benefit claims within 3 weeks. Only 6 states meet that standard right now. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, now on to another economic indicator. This morning, we learned by way of the Commerce Department that the trade deficit fell in June by more than 6%. Now, why is that exactly? Well, first, imports fell slightly because we, the consumers, haven't been buying as much stuff this year. But really, a big reason why the trade gap narrowed in June is because U.S. exports rose. It actually hit a record. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains.
A big reason U.S. exports have jumped is because we've been sending a lot of liquefied natural gas, LNG, to Europe. Economist Philip Verleger at the Niskanen Center says Russia's invasion of Ukraine has forced Europe to look for alternatives to Russian gas.
The U.S. happened to be constructing new LNG facilities across the Gulf, and Europe is going to buy as much as they can.
Russia's invasion is also causing countries in Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa to look for alternatives to Ukrainian wheat and corn.
So the United States was able to see some export business pick up.
That's Naomi Bloom at Total Farm Marketing. She says the U.S. has plenty of grain. Parts of Iowa, Indiana, and Illinois have gotten decent rain this year. And Bloom says the U.S. is well equipped to export that grain, too.
We can send it out through New Orleans. We can send it out through the Pacific Northwest. We have grain that might be on the eastern part of our growing region that can go out St. Lawrence Seaway or go out those southeastern U.S. ports.
The U.S. isn't just exporting more goods. It's services, too, like travel. And that spending can count as an export, too, says Teresa Fort, a professor at Dartmouth.
And so some of the service exports we see are likely a tourist coming into the United States, right, and consuming services here.
And Fort says the boost in exports of goods and services is happening while the U.S. dollar is strong, making American exports more expensive. Fort says if that weren't the case, exports might be even higher. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, kind of a mixed day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so we know that people on the internet rarely ever agree on anything, right? But these last couple weeks, I don't know, feels like people really from all corners of the internet have banded together. They are angry, they are frustrated, and they just want to see cute pictures of their friends eating spaghetti in far-flung places. Instagram is the subject of their grievances. The social media giant has made some changes. So these days, you're seeing a lot more suggested content, you know, posts from celebrities or from influencers pushing products, or just videos of strangers who've gone viral. And even though the company's CEO did walk back some of the changes, the app is still shifting its focus to entertainment to better compete with TikTok. These changes, yeah, they're annoying, but they're also a problem for artists. Marketplace's Savannah Marr explains.
For Denver-based photographer Ben Rasmussen, Instagram has served as sort of a gallery space.
It's like your own little outlet.
For building an audience and marketing to potential clients. But promoting his still photography on a platform that privileges video hasn't been easy.
Here's this book that's a combination of photographs and text, and we need to figure out how to tell people about this using 15 to 30 second videos.
Instagram's pivot has also shaken things up for Joanne Brings Thunder, a jewelry artist based in rural Wyoming. She can't rely on her Instagram following to drive sales like it used to.
Because of the algorithm changes, my outreach just doesn't seem to be there.
Social media can be a double-edged sword for artists, says Paco de Leon, an illustrator and a financial coach for creative professionals.
If like 90% of my revenue comes through Instagram, it's risky.
Because it's a company with its own profit incentives that artists don't have any control over. So should artists be pandering to the algorithm?
We all have like our lines of what we're willing to do, right? And I'm still struggling personally to figure out, you know, am I supposed to make my stuff animated?
Or act more like a content creator, which can be tough for those who like their art to speak for itself. Joanne Brings Thunder is begrudgingly giving Instagram Reels a try with some help from her teenage daughter.
She'll video me while I'm working, edit it for me and post it, but it's just another hindrance, I guess.
She's also relying more on an email newsletter to past customers, something that, unlike Instagram, she can control. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace. Coming up,
our love, when it comes down to it, it's hands down the strongest thing that I've ever felt.
That's cute. How's your Thursday going? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones lost 85 points, 0.2%, to end at 32,726. The Nasdaq rose 52 points, 0.4%, to close at 12,720. And the S&P 500 slid 3 points, less than 0.1%, to finish at 41.51. We heard from Savannah about people being mad at Instagram. Instagram's owner Meta gained 1%. Snap Inc. lost almost 0.7%. High temperatures and drought continue to bake much of the globe. Please, everybody, stay hydrated. That's also a reminder for myself. In water-related stocks, Essential Utilities dropped 0.7%. American Water Works rose 0.6%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. So we started the show up top talking about jobs with Mitchell. But we also got another piece of data this week, and that is the June Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, aka JOLTS, from the Labor Department. It gives us a snapshot of how the labor market is doing, and it also gets broken down by industry. So if you take a look at the data around restaurants, it saw both an uptick in hires and in separations. So that was item one. Item two is a show on FX called The Bear. It's gotten a lot of buzz, so you may have heard of it. It's about a chef who takes over his family restaurant in Chicago, and it's been described as a pretty accurate portrayal of what it's like to work in a kitchen. And for some, it's a reminder of why they left. Genevieve Yam is a former pastry chef, now an assistant editor at Epicurious, and she wrote about her experiences for Bon Appetit. Genevieve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the headline of your piece reads, quote, "I worked in Michelin-starred restaurants. The Bear's depiction of trauma is painfully real." What about it struck home for you?
I think a lot of people romanticize restaurant work and don't quite understand that it can be a very fast-paced and stressful environment. Mm-hmm. And I think the show did a really great job highlighting the reality. You see Carmi, the main character, he's really struggling to manage his team of cooks, and mm-hmm. he's dealing with the stress of invoices piling up on his desk. And I think it shows that a lot of cooks do neglect taking care of themselves because they have no other choice but to pour so much time and energy into what is a very stressful mm-hmm. job.
Yeah, I binged it over the weekend, and I was very stressed just watching it. So I can't imagine what it's like to actually be in a restaurant kitchen like that. And thinking mm-hmm. back on your time working in fine dining kitchens, is there a memory that really sticks with you that illustrates a lot of what we're talking about that you'd feel comfortable sharing?
Well, my experiences have really varied. I definitely have experienced, you know, my peers messing up my mise en place or...
Wait, that's wild. And can you explain what that is, actually?
Yeah, so it's just like your prep, you know, one of the scenes, mm-hmm. there's a character, Tina, who turns up the heat on another character's stock while her back is turned. And that kind of sabotage does happen in a lot of restaurants. Sometimes it can be for fun, but I've definitely been on the receiving end of some not quite nice things.
I see. And you know, I only if you feel comfortable sharing. I know you mentioned in the article that there was also an anecdote of like a blowtorch.
Yes. I had a sous chef burn me with a blowtorch at one of the restaurants that I worked at.
I don't even know how to respond to that. And what context? I mean, was it intentional?
I think it was because how you put away a blowtorch, you definitely have to be very mindful because you know that it is very hot at the end. And the most jarring part of that was mm-hmm. that the sous chef made eye contact with me the entire time they were doing it as well.
Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I mean, what mental toll did that take on you, you know, even outside of the kitchen?
You know, when I was working in restaurants, it was exactly what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm very thankful for all of the experiences that I've had because I really do think it made me a better cook. But I think in hindsight, I realized that it just wasn't for me and I needed a place with a healthier work environment.
Mm-hmm. And how did your life change once you left?
It was a very big adjustment for me. Mm-hmm. I was not used to having regular hours. You know, if someone couldn't make it into their shift, then I would have to come in and cover for them. I got married while I was still in the restaurant industry, and I still have never been on a honeymoon.
Oh, wow.
You know, I think for a lot of people, if your chef can't find time for you to take time off. You just don't.
Yeah, yeah. You know, shows like The Bear, I think, help start conversations around the toxicity that can exist in restaurant kitchens. Mm-hmm. But what do you think it'll take for there to be real change in the industry?
That's a really big question. Huge. And I'm not sure if there is one right answer for that. But I definitely think that the time we're in right now, like with inflation being so bad, I think a lot of restaurants that do want to pay their staff more are struggling mm-hmm. even more to do that now. And so I think it does come down to whether you have a social safety net. You know, when the pandemic happened, a lot of cooks who were laid off did not have significant savings. And I think also customers being able to recognize that, you know, a lot goes into creating a plate of food for you at a restaurant and being able to, you know, pay more for that or willing to pay more for that, I guess.
Yeah. Genevieve Yam is an assistant editor at Epicurious. Thanks so much, Genevieve, for coming on the show and being so open with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I host a podcast here at Marketplace called This is Uncomfortable. And there's a segment we do called Money Fight, where we try to get at the heart of a money fight between two people. Because oftentimes, fights about money are not really about the money. This next story is about a money fight around one of the biggest life decisions you can make. And that is when to have a baby. Now, government numbers tell us that the average cost for raising a kid through the age of 17 is $230,000. But most experts will tell you there's not really a magic number. Recently, I talked with two listeners, a couple, that's struggling to make that decision because of different views around money. They've been together for several years now, and almost every day, they talk about their imaginary future baby.
Well, first of all, let's refer to him as Bryson, okay?
That's Carrie Mansmith.
He's had a name for a long time. He's had a name since before we've gotten engaged, I believe.
And that's her wife, Natalia Mansmith. Carrie and Natalia are both nearly 30 years old, and they're both on the same page about wanting to have a baby. But whenever they talk about Bryson, their conversations often break down, ending in angry silence or hurt feelings. And that's because, from Carrie's perspective,
we can't afford to have a kid.
And it's like, I get so exhausted sometimes because I'm like, I'm ready.
But it just scares the heck out of me. Yeah. It scares the wits out of me.
Carrie works in the medical field and brings home the bulk of the money. And Natalia's going to start school soon to become a teacher. Together, they make about $110,000, which for many families would be more than enough. But Carrie still feels anxious.
Carrie, you have a cap on when she wants to have a baby. She says we have to make, well, I want to say $115,000 to be able to have a child with our combined income.
And they're incredibly close to making that much. But Carrie is firm with this number. I can imagine that it's especially tough as a same-sex couple. There are all these extra hurdles you have to go through, which can be very expensive.
I've poked around online at adoption agencies. It starts about at $20,000.
Wow.
There's also, they can do the, you know, IVF. That's also very expensive.
Mm-hmm. You're talking to two ladies that have $1,000 in their savings account, Rima.
Carrie says they've also got student debt, about $50,000. But despite all of this, Natalia tries to convince Carrie. She tells her, listen, we've got everything a kid would actually need. Shelter, food, and most importantly, a lot of love. And Carrie usually responds with something like,
you never had to worry about where your next meal was going to come from.
No.
And I think until you understand that, which I'm very thankful that you never have had to understand that, it takes a lot more than, you know, hugs and kisses.
Carrie had a hard upbringing. Her mom was addicted to drugs. They were on food stamps and were barely able to make ends meet. She was mocked by her classmates and even relatives. And so this fear of slipping back into her past, it haunts Carrie.
I just don't want my kid to hate me the way I hated my mother. So that's why I think to myself, I need to make so much money that my wife and my child will never have to wonder or worry.
For months now, they've been arguing over this, and it's starting to take a real emotional toll on them, especially on Natalia.
Like, it hurts me because it's like, if we're not ready, then we need to stop talking about it right now because it's making it harder than it already is.
Fights over money can often sound like a broken record. So when we suggested that maybe they chat with a financial therapist, which, yes, is a thing, they are both very eager to try it out.
Well, Natalia and Carrie, it's great to meet y'all.
This is Wendy Wright. She's a licensed financial therapist based in Colorado. And she basically gave Carrie and Natalia three big tips. First, she told him to stop talking cents and dollars and to focus more on the emotions.
So let's take that number right now, the 115. What does that number mean to you?
That number means my child never having to decide, I want to invite three friends to my birthday party, but I'm going to have to hear about my mom not being able to feed us later. Okay. That's what that means for me.
It sounds like it's connected to safety, security, protection, giving someone the nurture you want.
Next, Wendy told them to schedule regular time sessions for them just to talk about their finances. And lastly, she told them to try journaling about their future. Like, she told Carrie to write out specific financial scenarios she's afraid of and write a script for how she'll handle them.
It'll help you remember you have agency in your life and you have the ability to change the pattern. Money often feels like it's in charge of us, and we want to feel like we're in charge of it.
After the session, they decided they'd give these strategies an earnest effort, because at the end of the day, they're not ready to give up on each other.
Natalia is the love of my life. Like, I feel like I had to search, like, through many lifetimes to find Natalia, and I'm not kidding.
Our love, when it comes down to it, it's hands down the strongest thing that I've ever felt.
Right now, their goal is just to have financial conversations without things getting heated. Because they know if they want to have a baby, that first, it might mean taking some baby steps. By the way, if you want to hear more of Wendy's advice, like the importance of scheduling money dates, you can check out This Is Uncomfortable wherever you get your podcasts. We've got 6 seasons of stories about life and how money messes with it. This final note on the way out today. So after weeks of debate, the U.S. has officially declared monkeypox a public health emergency. Some states like California, New York, and Illinois have also issued emergency declarations. And on a practical level, this national declaration means federal agencies now have the power to direct money and speeding up the distribution of vaccines and treatments. It gives them access to emergency funding, and they can now hire additional workers to help deal with the outbreak. Now, just as a reminder, experts say the virus spreads mostly through close contact. It is rarely fatal, but it can be incredibly painful. The U.S. has among the highest rates of monkeypox infection in the world. More than 6,600 infections have been recorded, a number that is only expected to go up once testing improves. All right, we've got to go. No time for a moment of economic context today, so you'll have to find your own. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Sieg are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Rima Reis. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM. Hey everyone, it's Rima Reis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.